From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Mario Cuomo, the former governor of New York and one of the Democratic Party's most eloquent voices, talks with us about politics, speechwriting, and life after losing the 94 election. In his new book, Reason to Believe, he critiques the Republicans' contract with America. Also today, movie music. We talk with John Mauchery, founding conductor of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. He considers film music to be some of the greatest symphonic music of the 20th century. He elaborates on that point tonight when he hosts an edition of PBS's Great Performances devoted to movie music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Retired General Colin Powell is set to hold a news conference in Alexandria, Virginia at this hour to announce that he has decided not to run for president. A spokesman for the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has confirmed that Powell will not make a presidential bid. Powell's decision removes a major threat to the candidacy of GOP frontrunner Bob Dole. Dole picked up a key endorsement today. New Hampshire's popular governor Steve Merrill said he has decided to back the Senate majority leader because of Dole's military record and his devotion to public life.
I think we ought to be talking about what is going to change New Hampshire and what is going to change America. And in my opinion, Bob Dole has a solid record of accomplishment, and the voters of this state are going to see that. And hey, I'm proud to be working with him.
Dole was dutifully appreciative of the support.
We think it's a big, big step in the right direction, a big, big step toward the nomination, and for the right reason, because we have the same conservative philosophy, and we believe in fundamental change in America. We believe in family values, American values, and we believe in strong leadership worldwide.
The endorsement comes at a time when polls were showing Dole's popularity slipping in New Hampshire, the site of the leadoff presidential primary. Democrats held on to the Kentucky governorship with a win by Lieutenant Governor Paul Patton. For member station WFPL, John Gregory reports from Louisville.
Paul Patton's victory speech was an odd mixture of Democratic rhetoric tinged with Republican philosophy. He said his would be the most compassionate administration this century in Kentucky, but warned that he would get rid of big brother government. Some of Patton's sharpest words were directed at President Clinton on the issue of regulating tobacco.
Tobacco is a part of our economy, but it's also a part of our culture. We share, Mr. President, your desire to reduce teenage use of tobacco. But let us do that with a law, not a regulation.
In his concession speech, Larry Forgy said the Republican Party in Kentucky was far from dead because of this one election and encouraged his followers to look forward to next year's presidential and congressional races. For National Public Radio, I'm John Gregory in Louisville, Kentucky.
Two more suspects have been arrested in connection with the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, including the head of a militant right-wing Jewish group. Avishai Raviv is accused of knowing in advance of plans to kill Rabin. As he was brought into a courtroom today, he shouted that he had been subjected to a false arrest. The government of Israel is warning Israeli news media to restrict reporting of statements by extremists that could incite people to violence. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 37 points at 4833.88 in active trading of 282 million shares. This is NPR News. Let's go live now to General Colin Powell's news conference in Alexandria, Virginia.
With friends and advisors, I have spent long hours talking with my wife and children, the most important people in my life, about the impact an entry into political life would have on us. It would require sacrifices and changes in our lives that would be difficult for us to make at this time. The welfare of my family had to be uppermost in my mind. Ultimately, however, I had to look deep into my own soul, standing aside from the expectations and enthusiasms of others, because I believe I have a bond of trust with the American people. And to offer myself as a candidate for president requires a commitment and a passion to run the race and to succeed in the quest. The kind of passion and the kind of commitment that I felt every day of my 35 years as a soldier. a passion and commitment that, despite my every effort, I do not yet have for political life, because such a life requires a calling that I do not yet hear. And for me to pretend otherwise would not be honest to myself, it would not be honest to the American people, and I would break that bond of trust. And therefore, I cannot go forward. I will not be a candidate for president or for any other elective office in 1996. I know that this is the right decision for me. It was not reached easily or without a great deal of personal anguish. For me and my family, saying no was even harder than saying yes.
Retired General Colin Powell at a news conference in Alexandria, Virginia, where he said he does not have the political passion to make a run for the White House. His announcement ends weeks of political speculation. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been 1 year since Mario Cuomo was voted out of office. He'd served as New York State governor since 1983. Many Democrats assumed that when he left the governor's mansion, it would be to move higher up in politics. He became a rising star of the Democratic Party after he gave the keynote address at the 1984 Democratic Convention. He anguished over entering the 92 presidential campaign and decided against it. At that year's Democratic Convention, he gave Clinton's nominating address. He later declined a position on the Supreme Court. Since leaving the governor's mansion, Cuomo has joined a law firm, started a syndicated weekly radio program, and written a book. His new book, Reason to Believe, is a critique of the Republican contract with America. Cuomo's successor, Governor Pataki, reinstituted capital punishment shortly after taking office. I asked Cuomo, a staunch opponent of capital punishment, what his gut reaction was.
I had two reactions to it. One of them was gut, and the other was my mind. My gut was prepared. I knew what they were going to do. My mind tells me that it was a very dangerous signal that we received when, at the inauguration of the new governor, when he began his inaugural address, and I heard the first few paragraphs, and as a person who had the experience myself more than once, I thought this is a pretty good speech. But I kept listening, and he didn't reach any high notes. I mean, he didn't really have the audience thrilled by anything he said. And then he got to the sentence where he referred to bringing back the death penalty, and the audience exploded in exultation. And they were on their feet, and they were cheering, and they were whistling, and they were clapping. And I said, oh, my goodness. To be satisfied, to be pleased in this reaffirmation that we, the people, had gotten what we wanted, 80% of us voting for the death penalty, that's fine, that's understandable. But exultation, joy at knowing that you'll be able to execute people again, knowing that occasionally one of them will be found to have been innocent after all, knowing that it is, at the very least, an implicit statement by you, the government of this grand state, that brutality can be acceptable under some circumstances. Cheering that, smiling, laughing, slapping one another on the back, that was a little tough to take. So my reaction then intellectually was, this is a more troublesome and troubling time than I thought. And I thought I understood it.
There's an old saying that's become kind of a cliche by now, that a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged. Now, I know that at least two people in your family have been mugged. Both your wife and your daughter had been mugged, I think, in the 1980s, maybe the 70s. Did that affect your views on crime at all? Did you go through a period of being so shaken by that that you rethought how to deal with crime?
No. Each time that my family has experienced violence, I have been reconfirmed in my attitude toward the death penalty and punishment generally. Matilda and Christopher, our youngest, were mugged. Our home was broken into while we were in the bedroom, and I slept every night after that with a 36-inch Louisville Slugger next to the bed, believe it or not. A Louisville Slugger is a very big bat if it's a 36-inch bat. But on two occasions, one of my daughters was attacked by the same man, accosted, touched, molested. And the second time, he left a mark on her breast with his cigarette. And we never found him, although we looked for a long time. And she did mug shots and thought she was able to identify him. And all those experiences drew the same reaction from me. A terrible anger. Kind of anger that made me believe that the greatest blessing was we never found the man. That I wasn't there when the mugging occurred because I might have gotten killed or the mugger might have gotten killed. That I was capable of using all of what was then my considerable physical strength to hurt whoever was hurting my daughter or threatening to hurt my family, that I might even kill them unless restrained. And I felt that each time. I feel that almost just thinking about it. And I know that that's wrong. And experiencing it reminds me that it is a natural impulse which we ought not to encourage.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mario Cuomo, and the occasion for his visit is a new book called Reason to Believe. Do you see yourself running again for office at some time in the future?
I wouldn't rule it out, only because my life has been a series of improbabilities. You know, all the good things that happened in my life were things I never would have expected, never thought I deserved. Matilda being the first of them. You know, if you had said to me, hey, Mario, you're gonna get the most beautiful woman available, the smartest, the best mother, and the best friend. And she's going to stay with you for 41 years, although you're a terrible pain in the neck increasingly over that entire period. I'd say, well, that can't happen. And the governorship before that would have been improbable, and three terms surely would have been impossible. And an invitation to the Supreme Court is a fantasy and an illusion. So I'm beyond saying no to anything. You know, I'm at a stage where I'm grateful for everything and open to any possibility, good or bad. No, I wouldn't rule out politics. I love the public life.
You are, I think, widely regarded as among the most eloquent speechmakers today. And you've said that you usually write your own speeches, or at least write most of it, that in fact you have trouble delivering a speech that was written for you, a major speech, it just doesn't work for you. Why not? How often did you try it?
I never actually read a speech written for me, but I will tell you that in the beginning of my career, before I was in public life, I represented authors, and I knew people very
well. As a lawyer.
As a lawyer. Jimmy Breslin was a friend of mine. Adam Walensky, who was a genius who worked for Robert Kennedy, a real genius. And all of these people at one time or another wrote things. Steve Schlesinger, who is a friend of mine still, who is an author himself and the son of Arthur Schlesinger Jr., another brilliant person. All of these people wrote things for me. They write much better than I do, but they don't write in my cadences. They don't write in my words. They don't feel what I feel.
So were you ever at a podium reading one of their speeches,
no,
realizing this isn't going to work for me?
No, but I read them before I went to the podium and said, I can't read these words. As some of the words were much better than any words I could contrive. And that by itself, would have been a giveaway. I don't speak this way. I don't write this way. You know, you guys do, your prose. In the end, it's a lot easier to use your own words, even if you don't write as well. And, you know, this is an interesting thing. You'll get people who will come and say, I'd like to write speeches for you. And you do use speechwriters if you're a governor, because no matter how much you want to write for yourself, I write all the stuff you'll ever hear. But every day you may have two or three or four stops where you have to talk to this group or that group, you know, on this subject or that subject. And what you normally do is you have cards written for you, and you go and you read from the podium about the award being presented to this osteopath for the wonderful thing he did.
Mm-hmm.
So you do need to, and there are people who write letters for you or things like that. And what will happen is some of the best writers will try to write something for you, And it's not as good as the memorandum they dashed off last night. Why? Because they attempt to emulate your cadences, your style, and that distorts everything they do. So it's very tough to find a Peggy Noonan who suits Reagan so perfectly. I mean, either Reagan became Noonan or Noonan became Reagan. I don't know how it worked out, but, you know, that was a match made in heaven, and it worked. But those are very rare.
My guest is Mario Cuomo. He's written a new book called Reason to Believe. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with the former governor of New York, Mario Cuomo. What did you do to prepare your address, your keynote address at the Democratic Convention in 84?
I didn't want to do the keynote. Timmy Russett worked for me at the time. Tim Russett, who is now a big, big star, and he was my director of communications. My son Andrew was in the administration. He had been my campaign manager, and the two of them knew that Mondale had asked me to do the keynote, and they asked what I thought, and I said, I don't want to do it. I'm not good enough. Nobody knows me in the country. I've only won one election. It's not good for Fritz. I want Mondale to win, and he needs a heavyweight. We should get Ted Kennedy. Kennedy was not supporting Mondale yet before the convention. I went to see Kennedy. It was the only time I'd ever seen him. I was with him until 3 o'clock in the morning. I called Mondale the next day. I was delighted. I said, I think I can get Ted Kennedy to endorse you and to endorse you big time, but he has to be the keynote speaker at the convention. Mondale didn't like that idea at all. He said, I don't want Ted Kennedy. I want you. I said, nobody knows me. I made a big argument. And he got irritated, Mondale. He said, look, you said you would do anything that you could to have me win. I said, that's right. He said, well, this is what I'm telling you I need. So I went to Russett and Andrew, and I told them, and I said, this is awful. So now I had to sit down to write a speech, and I was negative about the proposition. I took my inaugural address and tried to refashion it as a speech. I spent 3 nights by myself writing, not days, nights. In the days I did my work, and at nights I wrote. Then I brought in Tim Russett and Andrew, and Tim Russett changed one paragraph and said, put this paragraph at the top. Andrew said, add some stuff about your mama and papa. That's my mama and papa. I said, no, people don't want to hear about mama and papa. He says, yes, yes, you have to do that. That's important. And that's what we did. I wrote the speech. I was very dissatisfied with it. We went to San Francisco. Andrew and I put it on the teleprompter the day before we had to give the speech. I went maybe one quarter through the teleprompter reading, and it was awful. We killed the teleprompter, said, forget about it. I went out, played a softball game with Brokaw, Jennings, and a few of the other people. Hit a double, incidentally.
Yes.
then gave the speech the next day, and it was very well received.
So had you rewritten it in the interim, or what?
I had written it, rewritten it, but I never liked it. What I did do with that speech, that one should do with every speech they ever give if you have the time, I read it to about 15 or 20 people in my office in New York City, including some elevator operators, secretaries, a cleaning woman who I'd asked specifically to come in. I had had some talks with her at night, and she was a very interesting person. I came as close as I could to a kind of American audience that you might get lucky with on television. And I read the thing, and then I just asked them to give me quick reactions. And one said, sounds too liberal. One says, you didn't mention this. One says, I took all those reactions, rewrote the speech, went to Albany, and read it to some people in Albany. Whole speech. I put them in a room and read the whole thing and got some reactions from them. These were kind of polls, surveys, focus groups. And then used all of their remarks to rewrite it. On the plane going there, Jimmy Breslin, I went. I guess the day before, Jimmy Breslin came and sat next to me. And he said, may I read your speech? I said, no, Jimmy, because if you read it, you're going to see that it's not as good as it could be. You're going to make suggestions. I'm going to get all filed up. He said, I promise I won't. He I gave him the speech. He took out his pencil. I pulled the pencil out of his hand. And he said, I can't read it without the pencil. So I gave him the pencil back. He read it, but I wouldn't let, this is the truth, I wouldn't let him make any marks, okay? He finishes the speech. He hands it to me. He says, this is going to be a knockout. I said, Jimmy, you don't know what you're talking about. I said, that's what you should stay writing columns, writing books. Just leave the politician's job to me. I said, you did a lousy job when you were a candidate, and, you know, you should stay out of the business. And Breslin says, no, this will be a knockout. And it was much, much better received than I thought. Was it well prepared? No. Was it well written? I do not believe it was well written. Was it well delivered? Not really. Baltimore Sun just did a piece on my book that's overall very complimentary, but they talk about the 84 convention speech, and they said there was nothing imposing about the speaker or the delivery of the speech, and I think he was right. The reason it worked so well, the things I said in the speech, the people were feeling at the moment.
Well, the conceit of the speech was a tale of two cities, and you were comparing the Reagan image of a shining city on a hill with what you perceived as the reality of cities in America, where there were a lot of people who were poor and struggling and lacking in education and so on. Tell me how you came up with that conceit.
During the writing of the speech, someone gave me an article involving the city on the hill. I'm vague on this, and Reagan's reference to the city on a hill and the history of the idea of the city on a hill. And the rest was easy. That incidentally, was not the only metaphor in the speech, and that was one of the problems with the speech. Is there were, there were a couple of metaphors, like the wagon train, which I preferred. You know, the wagon train goes west, discharging people along the way. We believe there's room in the wagon for everybody. Or the table, Rabbi Hillel and Francis of Assisi and crumbs from the table. There's room for the table for everybody. I mean, so there were a lot of metaphors. It was not an excellent speech as written. It was not an excellent speech as delivered. I repeat, the reason it got the reaction it did, and it did bring people to tears. It almost brought me to tears. And the reason Walter Cronkite and Brinkley said extravagant things about it was because of the reaction to the speech. And that reaction was triggered by the fact that what I was saying, people were feeling. I didn't lift them to a new level. I didn't introduce them to a truth that hadn't occurred to them. I had them look into their own hearts. And when I said to them, look, wouldn't it be better to be the family of America sharing one another's benefits and burdens? People understood that. They wanted to hear it. They liked the idea that we could love one another intelligently and with good results. Incidentally, I don't believe you could give that speech today.
Why not?
And get the same result. Because I don't believe people feel that way this moment.
They feel how instead?
I said after the Reagan years that Ronald Reagan, who as an individual is a marvelous human being and benign and sweet and compassionate and charming, but his worst legacy was that he made the denial of compassion respectable. He made America feel that, hey, look, there's no point in wondering whether you can save the poor. You can't. Wondering whether you can do more to put the unemployed to work. You can't. Wondering whether you should struggle harder to find shelter for the homeless. They don't want it. Don't feel guilty. You've done more than you should do. They're on their own now, and you shouldn't be troubled by it.
One of your now famous speeches was delivered at Notre Dame University in 1984, and the subject was why, as a Catholic and as a politician, you felt that you could support a woman's right to abortion even though the Catholic Church opposed it. Why, as a politician, you felt you didn't need to, that it would be inappropriate to do something because the Church said that this is what Catholics should do, that you needed to think of people who weren't Catholics, you know, to think of the larger public. What did the Church have to say in response to that speech? Did you get a reaction from either the Church you attended or from people more highly placed in the Church?
On the point that was most important to me, the Church spoke very carefully. Now, the most important thing for me was, theologically, can I be Roman Catholic, believe what I believe as a politician, you know, what appropriate political conduct is, and still be absolutely sound theologically? And articles appeared all across the United States, especially by the order priests, Jesuit priests, saying, we've studied this. His theology is intact. This is theologically acceptable. It's theologically sound. Now, politically, the church might want you to take a different position. Politically, they might say, look, it's better if you condemn abortion because that's our church teaching. But there is no question that my position, which essentially was, look, I believe as a Catholic my conduct should proceed along certain lines. When it comes to abortion, it's largely irrelevant to me as a man, but my position should be abortion is wrong, period, and that's what I advise my daughters, that's why I advise my wife, etc., and if I'm a Catholic doctor, that creates certain obligations too. Incidentally, that's also true of contraceptives, the use of contraceptives. That is what I believe as a Catholic. You're not allowed to use artificial devices. The natural law, my church teaches me that I cannot use contraceptives. I say, as a governor, I am not obliged to say to the people of the state of New York, you must not use contraceptives because I believe it is wrong to use contraceptives. You must not have divorce because I believe it is wrong to have divorce, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that was my position. Theologically, the church's answer was, as far as I can tell, nobody from the hierarchy ever said he's wrong theologically. What they didn't like, what my own cardinal didn't like, Cardinal O'Connor, was that it appeared to many people I was differing with my church. I was not.
So when you were wrestling with this question over abortion and the church and your role as a governor, did this cause you great anguish, or were you just confident right from the get-go that...
No, it caused me great anguish. I wasn't sure I should do it. I wouldn't have done it if the archbishop, then later the cardinal, hadn't, in his first few weeks as archbishop of the Archdiocese of New York, come from Scranton, Pennsylvania, gone on a television show, and in answer to the question, do you think people like Mario Cuomo might be excommunicated from the church, paused, didn't reject that possibility, and allowed it, therefore, to fester in the minds of some, including my very youngest child, who happened to be watching at the time with me and Matilda, my wife, and that went through me like a dagger. And if it hadn't been for that, I never would have written the speech, I never would have spoken on the subject. It wasn't easy to do, and I did it with great, great reluctance and considerable trepidation.
Mario Cuomo has written a new book called Reason to Believe. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Dutton, publisher of Road Warriors, Dreams and Nightmares Along the Information Highway by Daniel Burstein and David Klein. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, great movie music. We talk with conductor John Malcheri, the host of a documentary about movie music to be broadcast tonight on the PBS Great Performances series. We're listening to Bernard Herrmann's score for The Day the Earth Stood Still, featuring Malcheri conducting the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. Also, we continue our interview with Mario Cuomo. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Mario Cuomo. The former governor of New York has written a new book called Reason to Believe. In your speeches and, you know, in talks with the public, you've often discussed your mother and the impact she had on you. I know she died last spring. She was from a poor village in Italy, an uneducated woman. Did she think education was important for you when you were growing up?
She couldn't read or write Italian. She couldn't read or write English. Papa couldn't read or write Italian. He learned a little English from Mr. Kessler, who put him in a grocery store in the Depression in South Jamaica, Queens. And, they lived and died for education. I bring in the report card to Papa in the grocery store behind the counter. He would look at the grades. A, 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 B. He'd get to the B, boom, it hit me with the back of his hand. He didn't know anything except B was not A, and B was not as good as A. He saved money in little bank books. Andrea Cuomo in trust for Franco Cuomo, my brother. Another book in trust for Maria, my sister. Another book in trust for Mario. And what was it for? You should go to school. He didn't know which school, how, what. He knew that really good schools cost money. And that's what the bank books were for. Not for him, not for a house, not for a new coat, not for a vacation. Just for education.
Were they surprised at the extent of your success?
Papa never lived to see it. Mama, I'll tell you a quick funny story about Mama. Papa and Mama thought it was wonderful when I graduated college. Law school, forget about it. Actually a lawyer, can you believe this? When I wrote a book in the 60s, my father, you know, he was showing people in the store the book. He couldn't read it, but he showed everybody. And, they were thrilled beyond words. When I became a politician, they were devastated. Why would you want to do this? You've been honest all your life, my father said. How can you be a politician? And they were crushed. So I had to tell them, look, beside that, I lost my first race, and they felt even worse. But then I went into government anyway, and I told them, Pa, I'm going to stay in politics because that's the way you get to be a judge. That was something he understood, judge, you know, that had dignity and that had security. He died before I ever won election. I won election as governor. I'm standing on the platform with my mother, and the man goes to the mic and says, Mario Cuomo is the first Italian-American ever elected to a full term as governor of the state of New York. A lot of applause. I put my arm around Mama. I said, what do you think of your son now, Mom? She says, there's no bed, but when are you going to be judge? I'm not sure she ever thought I was a success.
You played on the Pittsburgh Pirates farm team. Briefly, how serious were you about becoming a player? Did you ever think you'd really become a baseball player?
No, this was another one of the lucky breaks in my life. I think the scouts saw me on some of my better days. Mickey Mantle only got $1,100 when he signed in 1949. Yogi Berra got $500. Joe Garagiola got $250. I got $2,000. And the scouting report described me as the best prospect in the Pittsburgh organization. With all of that, I didn't believe I'd do well. I went away. I did extremely well when I started. Then I got injured and came back from that. And then I got hit in the back of the head with a pitch, lost my eyesight, and was out of, and never played another baseball game for the rest of my life. They gave me a contract the next year, but the Pittsburgh Pirate doctors wouldn't let me play the next year because, you know, that was before MRIs and CAT scans. All they had was x-rays, and they'd see this black lump, this hematoma on the brain or whatever the mark was. And until that dissipated, unless they opened you up, which I wouldn't let them do, it wasn't safe to play, they thought. So I had a very short career, but a lot of fun, and used the $2,000 to buy Matilda a ring.
Did your parents want you to become an athlete?
No. My father said no to the contract when I first explained to him. I was underage, and he had to approve. And he said no because he asked some of the customers, and they said if he plays baseball, he won't finish college. And he explained that to me, and I explained it to the scout who explained it to Branch Rickey, who was a lawyer and a genius, the man who brought Jackie Robinson into baseball, who brought us the first black player, and who was general manager of the Dodgers, then moved over to Pittsburgh. He wrote a beautiful letter to my father congratulating him and saying, you're right for wanting your son to get a college education, and I will stipulate in the contract he signs with us that he will never have to come to spring training or even to start the season until he finishes his college in the spring. And that's what happened. I went to DeLand on the Easter vacation, DeLand, Florida, for spring training, and didn't report to the team until the middle of May after I finished my semester at St. John's University.
Was it embarrassing to show up to the minor leagues with a letter from your father?
No, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing to have to say to the scout, I know you want to give me $2,000, which is more money than I'll ever make, for playing ball, but my old man says that he doesn't want me to do it. That was really embarrassing. But it turned out very well, and Branch Rickey, I think, handled it very nicely.
Why did you decide to do the Doritos commercial with the former governor of Texas after you both lost last year?
That's a really interesting question. First of all, it produced some wonderful opportunities for us. You know, they give you money for those things, and if you have charities you're concerned about, you can do good things there, and sometimes you can use the money yourself too. But apart from that, if you watch that Doritos commercial again and listen to the words, we did most of the writing, and the one condition that Ann and I had is we don't want to sell product. We want a chance to make a statement, and the statement should be, okay, we lost, but we don't regret. We're not going to despair. We're not going to be bitter about it. We're not going to blame anybody for it. What we're going to say to America is, look, change can be good for you, and let's take a look at this, and let's make the most of what we can, most that we can with these new conditions. And that is exactly the sentence I use. I only have one sentence in it, really. And what I say to Ann is something like, look, Ann, you shouldn't feel that way. Change can be good for us. We ought to seize this opportunity to reconsider, and to go forward and to make the place better. And she says, I think you're right, Mario. And she picks up the Doritos bag and say, this is a new change bag of Doritos. I'm going to try it. And so we thought it was fun. And that's the reaction we got from people.
Now that you have been out of office for a year, are you ever sorry that you refused the Supreme Court seat or decided not to enter the presidential race?
No. At the time I made those judgments, I think they were the best judgments I could have made. I made them honestly, sincerely, and whether they're right, wrong, doesn't matter much. But I thought them through, and no, I don't have any regrets.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Mario Cuomo has written a new book called Reason to Believe. Coming up, great movie music. This is Fresh Air. Many great movies also gave us great music, music with romantic sweep, like the theme from Gone with the Wind, music that sets your nerves on edge, like the shower scene music from Psycho. My guest, John Mautcheri, wants to make sure the best film scores have a life outside of the movies. As the founding director of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra, he often conducts movie music and has even restored some old scores. He has three recent albums of film music. The Sound of Hollywood features classic themes. Between Two Worlds features the film score by Eric Korngold, and Journey to the Stars features music from science fiction and horror films. Tonight he hosts an edition of the PBS Great Performances series devoted to film music. The first score that took hold of him as a child was Franz Waxman's score for The Bride of Frankenstein, which Mautcheri conducts on Journey to the Stars. John Mautcheri, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I really like the way the drum is used in this because it's either like a heartbeat which the monster doesn't really have.
Well, yeah,
or,
you know,
it's like the heavy footsteps of the monster approaching. I don't know what's actually happening.
Well, what's
in the
interesting
movie when this is played. Yeah.
Well, it's the creation of the female monster. Mm-hmm. This whole sequence is the actual moment where they give her heartbeat, and at the beginning you see the little meter going boom, boom, boom. Mm. And this continues through the whole sequence as a kind of, it is both the march as well as the heartbeat. And, you know, this idea also comes out of The Flying Dutchman from Wagner, but it's, of course, then later Waxman writes the music to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and he uses boom, 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 which sounds an awful lot like the music to Jaws, which, of course, was something that John Williams knew quite well. And the use of the heartbeat, of course, is part of the animatopoetic part of Western musical language, you know, and Waxman is brilliant. It's like, it's kind of a supernatural bolero, right? I mean, the tempo doesn't move, and what we have at the end is a monster. I have Elsa Lanchester with a permanent wave.
What do you think the importance of film music is in the larger scheme of classical music and pop?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the words that is, you know, is, but you hit both magic words. You hit both of my buttons at once. You said pop and you said classical. I think we have this problem with the word classical music, and I'm starting to prefer using the word classic music because I just don't understand now what classical music means. Just like pop, I think that every composer, you know, Verdi, Wagner, all of them wanted to be popular. So, all of this seems to come together in film music, which, like 19th century music, had as its basis the popular music of the time, and then they kind of elevated it or they made it more complicated by writing large symphonic scores. So the film music continued to be influenced by everything that was going on in pop music from, you know, in the 30s right through the 50s right through to today, whereas classical music, if you can use that word, stopped being influenced by popular music. In other words, you don't have tangos and you don't have rock and roll and then you don't have rap music in any way, you know, influencing the music of Stockhausen, Boulez or whatever. They stopped that. Whereas, equivalently, in the 19th century, it was normal to have a tarantella, a march, a waltz, a song being elevated into something which people call art music. Now, therefore, film music is in fact the thing, is the music that continued this great process. And ironically enough, you know, it comes at a time when Hitler tried to get rid of these composers, tried to get rid of every Jewish composer who ever lived. And those who escaped and lived and came to Hollywood and were successful as film composers, basically, as a result of that, their music was heard by many, many millions of more people than would have heard them if they had simply written a symphony or an opera.
Well, I think that leads us right into some other music that you've been conducting. You have a new recording of Eric Korngold's music, and he is an example of a European composer who fled the Nazis, ended up in America, and ended up writing for movies.
Right. Erich Wolfgang Korngold was one of those child prodigies. It's interesting how most of these great film composers were child prodigies. It's inevitably a story of each of them playing the violin when they were four or five, you know. And they usually had big careers as symphonic or operatic composers. They happened to be Jewish or Hungarian or whatever, and they had to flee. They came to America. They were enormously successful at writing for this new medium, and the talent for doing that, I don't think, is anything different from writing, you know, operas or ballets. It's just some different requirements.
Now, a lot of the European composers who fled the Nazis ended up in the United States writing for Hollywood. Were they writing for movies in Europe, or were they writing for, you know, symphonies in the symphony hall?
Well, it's different for each one. In other words, Franz Waxman had worked with UFA, the great film company in Berlin. He, in fact, had orchestrated the music to The Blue Angel. And then he came to Hollywood and continued writing for films. He wrote Bride of Frankenstein. Korngold had written five operas and had written a lot of symphonic works and had never written for the movies in Vienna, but in fact was invited to America in the 30s, when he could still travel back and forth, to work on Midsummer Night's Dream at the Hollywood Bowl, which became a movie. And he so loved working for the movies that he would do, you know, a movie score once every year or so, but go back to Europe and continue to write, and simply continue to write, you know, operas. He had to stay, of course, Eric Korngold, because in 1938 he was looking at a picture called Robin Hood and deciding not to write the music when his father called from Vienna and said, "You can't come home." And in fact, later on in life, Eric Wolfgang Korngold said it was Robin Hood that saved his family's life.
He couldn't go home because the Nazis had invaded Austria.
Exactly, the Anschluss, and he couldn't go back.
Now, Eric Korngold's movie scores include The Adventures of Robin Hood, Seahawk, Captain Blood, King's Row. Now, we've selected some music from Between Two Worlds from your new recording. And I'd like you to explain what's happening in the movie while this passage of music plays.
Well, you know, at this point in the pictures, very early in the picture, there's the Blitz, and the characters are trying to escape from the ticket office where they're buying tickets for the ship that will take them to America, and the car is destroyed by a bomb, and the composer, who doesn't even get on the ship, is seen trying to commit suicide in his apartment, but by putting the gas on in the stove, and it all dissolves into suddenly they're all being on a ship, and they are sailing between heaven and hell, between life on the planet and life on the next plane. And so Korngold wrote this score, which it was very, you know, very personal kind of score, and full of mystery and romance. And the picture itself isn't all that good. It's pretty good, but it's not all that good.
Let's hear some of Eric Korngold's music for the film Between Two Worlds, as conducted by my guest John Mautcherry. The siren that we hear that opens this passage of music, how does that siren work in the film?
Well, again, it's what indicates to everybody that, you know, that there's going to be a bombing. And interestingly enough, at this period of time, many composers use the siren in their orchestral scores. This whole series of music that we're recording with London Records called Entarte de Musique, the degenerate music, it's amazing how many times one hears that siren. I'm sure that was the sound that terrified people more than anything, because it was the indication that in some time in the next 10, 15 minutes or minute that one might die or the buildings around you might be destroyed.
I'm glad you mentioned that this Korngold recording is part of a larger series called Entarteta music, and that means degenerate music. That's the word that the Nazis used to describe the kind of music that they thought was dangerous. What fell under this category of degenerate music?
Well, the idea came, the word is an invented word from the 19th century, talking about people who were degenerate, not in the sense of their behavior, but are actually physically and spiritually missing things and are actually lower than human. And then they used it for artwork, and they showed how the paintings of cubists or expressionists or impressionists were Entartet. And then there was a display of Entartete Musik, which was degenerate music. The people who fell, the composers, the list of composers who fell under this list that the Nazis put together, basically were Jewish composers, composers who were politically not in agreement with them, say a communist, homosexuals, gypsies, anybody influenced by jazz, black music they considered all jazz music to be black music. And all of that music, therefore, was then bundled under one title called degenerate music. This is, of course, became absurd, because all the operettas that were being performed in Berlin and Vienna were written by Jewish composers. And ironically, the very moment in which Hitler and his people were trying to get rid of music composed by Jews was exactly the moment when the Jewish population of Germany and Austria were in the full bloom of the one of the greatest renaissances of creativity known to mankind. This very small percentage of world population, the Jewish population, was suddenly coming forth with the greatest violinists, pianists, composers, singers, and directors and designers. And Erich Wolfgang Korngold is simply one of the composers on the list. And, you know, Béla Bartók, who wasn't on the list, wrote the letter to the Nazis and said he was really insulted that he'd been left off because it was such an incredible group of people. And what's interesting about it is the people on this list, those who survived, then got to suffer after the war because, for some reason, you know, it would be naive of us to think that the people who ran the musical establishments of Germany and Austria suddenly were replaced by the good guys in September of 1945. I mean, who was running all the organizations? The same people. And so there was tremendous punishment for those who survived, which is why this series is essential, because 50 years later, most of this music has never been performed or recorded. It's astonishing and shocking, but true.
My guest is John Malcheri, the conductor of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Malcheri. Tonight he hosts an edition of the PBS Great Performances series devoted to film music. You are the founding conductor of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra.
Yes.
Which conducts a lot of film music. Is it exclusively film music?
No, but since they created this orchestra for me and had no particular idea of what the orchestra would be, I said, well, we're in Los Angeles. The musicians who play in the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra make their living playing film music. They are, in fact, the legacy, this great legacy, which is a mixture of American culture and European culture. So why don't we have our raison d'etre be, in fact, that we play this music, since these people make a living doing it every day of their lives? The result is that they are, you know, what Vienna Philharmonic is to Beethoven and Mahler, the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra is to the film music.
What do you hope the orchestra of the future will be? What would you like to see the orchestra of the future play?
Well, I would like to see what we're calling film music, because I would say we're talking about tonal orchestral music would probably be a better word for it. I would like to see that in concerts that there is no particular distinction or ghettoizing of film music, just like if you have an overture to an opera, no one says it's got to be opera night at the Philharmonic. But in fact, that good music is simply played without reference to category or where the music came from or how it was written, but simply listen to it and judge it, and if you find that it's good music, play it.
I'll tell you what I'd like to see.
Yeah, I forgot to ask you. And Terry,
yeah, you
what would
to ask
you like
me, right.
to see? And Terry, what would you like to see?
Thank you. Yes, I would like to see orchestras playing more extended jazz works, Broadway music, film scores, in addition.
Well, you see, this is part of the ghettoization here. Now, that's why I once said the Pops concert is the worst idea of all time, because it implies that other concerts are not for people.
Well, can I stop you for a second here?
Sure.
When I think of Pops orchestras, I think of, like, well, maybe in theory I like the music, but it's going to be schlocked up a little bit.
Well, that's the problem, you see, because you have this impression because of the Boston Pops arrangements, which they play continuously, that originated from the 50s and 60s.
Well, and extended into the 70s. Let me, with all due respect to Arthur Fiedler, when Saturday Night Fiedler came out, after Saturday Night Fever, that really, you know, that was the final nail in the coffin.
Can I just say that this is, you can't blame Arthur for this, just like you can't blame John for this. Part of this blame comes from, unfortunately, public television. What happened was that a normal Pops concert in the days of Arthur Fiedler would begin is in three-thirds. The first third, symphonic overtures and symphonic movements. I mean, Dvorak, Wagner, etc., Rachmaninoff. Second part of the Pops concert was either an entire Mozart piano concerto, you know, a concerto of some kind, and I mean a concerto. And then the third third was what you think of as a Pops stuff. It was dessert, okay? Then when Pops went on television and when RCA was marketing the Pops idea, they focused on that last third. So people think that a Pops concert is, you know, is Chet Atkins and his group performing for an hour or whatever it is, or just, you know, a pop soloist. Whereas in fact, I don't wish to pick on him particularly, but I think about what happens in Pops concerts throughout America. In fact, the Pops concert, as it was developed by Arthur Fiedler, was at least two-thirds, you know, rooted in classical music. Also, if you look at Arthur Fiedler's programs from, say, 1943, what was he playing? A suite from Oklahoma. In 1943, Oklahoma was brand new. He was playing contemporary music. And one of the things that's terrible about Pops concerts is so much of it is referential to a time when most of the people in the audience weren't even alive. I find that really odd. So I would like to see that there would just be concerts, and they would be a good blend of things that would take an audience on a journey. And yes, you're right. Of course, there should be jazz music, and there should be Broadway music and film music, just as there's opera music and symphony music and ballet music. It's a question of choice and to not... You know, I used to say that the 20th century suffered from hardening of the categories, and that's, in fact, what we've tried to get rid of.
I want to play something else from your... album of film music, Journey to the Stars, and it features science fiction and fantasy film music. You restored some of the score from Things to Come.
Yes.
Just say a couple of words for us before we hear an excerpt of this about why you spent so much time on this score.
Things to Come is one of the great science fiction pictures, one of the great pictures of all time, and it came from England, Alexander Korda. It predicts the Second World War and predicts the city of the future. Its influence on every science fiction picture ever made is palpable to anybody who knows it. Interestingly enough, the composer, Arthur Bliss, who became the official composer of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, was hired to write the music, and he wrote the themes with H.G. Wells present. This is H.G. Wells wrote the screenplay. So here's a case where the composer actually worked with the book writer, playing the themes before the movie was actually even filmed, and then rewriting it after the film was made. And I thought, wow, this is such a great score, and it's unavailable. And Lady Bliss, by the way, the widow of the composer, helped support the restoration of it. So it's one of the happiest things on this record is that I had a chance to conduct and restore so much of Things to Come by Arthur Bliss.
John Malcherry, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's been a great pleasure.
John Malcherry is the founding conductor of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. Tonight he hosts an edition of the PBS Great Performances series devoted to film music. His latest CDs include Korngold, Between Two Worlds, The Sound of Hollywood, and Journey to the Stars, featuring music from science fiction and horror films. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Marina Bander. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown, publisher of Tom, The Unknown Tennessee Williams, a biography by Lyle Leverick. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.